Gutflix is the streaming platform for digestive health professionals. Discover curated GI content on IBD, hepatology, endoscopy, and more, as well as expert courses, UEG Week recordings, and podcasts personalized to your clinical interests. Start exploring at gutflix.eu. Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Agla, and I'm the host of UEG Podcast, educational and hopefully fun dive into GI world and beyond. We're happy to have you with us for another exciting episode. So today we're talking about the rise and hopefully fall of eosinophilic esophagitis. It is a great pleasure to introduce today's guest, one of the discoverers of eosinophilic esophagitis, forefront researcher and renowned expert who had a rare experience of recognizing a new disease, Professor Alex Straumann. Welcome to UEG Podcast, Professor.
Dear Egli, dear colleagues, the title, The Rise of EoE, is absolutely perfect because we have a good evidence that it is a new disease. The first description of the disease was in the early 90s by Stephen Atwood and by myself. This was the recognition, and we have evidence, it's speculative, but we have good evidence that the first appearance of the disease was few years before. It is definitely a new disease. Why? The impaction of ordinary food in a non-structured esophagus didn't occur 4 or 5 decades ago. We had obstructions in a tumor or a peptic stricture, or if patients swallow a fish one or things like that, but that ordinary food in a non-structured esophagus remains stuck. This didn't occur.
So how did you recognize this? Because you were one of the first to describe this. How did you recognize that this is a separate entity? And how did it come about? Did you take biopsies from peculiar patients?
My first patient was a 10-year-old boy. February 26, 1989, he was referred as an emergent case with a long-lasting food impaction. Over 8 hours, the food stuck in the esophagus, a complete obstruction. I removed the bolus and I took some biopsies, and the pathologist called me 2 days later back. This esophagus is full of eosinophils. I never have seen such a picture.
And what was your first idea when he said that it's eosinophilic?
No idea. The only idea, I had two ideas. One, I have to make a literature search. But at that time, in 89, we had no search machines. I found only 3 case reports, one from achalasia, another case had a systemic eosinophilic disease, but an isolated EoE, we had no publications. The second thing I did, I remembered that I have seen a patient few months before, a 45-year-old engineer with solid foot dysphagia. I thought, you are stressed because you are an engineer. Please keep cool. And now I contacted the patient again. I scoped him. This time I took biopsies, and the pathologist again, Alex, what are you doing? Full of eosinophils. This was number two. And in the same year, 89, a third patient. And then I was convinced this is something. This is not only a spleen in my head.
So this happened in 89, right? So what happened in 89. So what happened in the 5 years afterwards before you published the data?
I presented these 3 cases in a regional gastro meeting. And within a rather short time, we had total 10 patients. And This case series I published in 94, beginning 94, and few months before, another publication, a case series with 12 patients. Stephen Edwards was the author of this publication, and absolutely identical, mainly male patients, difficulties in swallowing solid food. The majority of patients had other allergies, and then the food impaction and the esophagus full of eosinophils. We had these two case series published in 1993 and 4, and this, I would say, this was the recognition of EoE. When the appearance of EoE, the first appearance, we don't know exactly, but because the manifestation is so dramatic with food impactions, I think it is a new disease. It might be the onset in the 80s of the last century, 4 or maximum 5 decades ago. And before, this disease didn't exist.
Yeah, that's very peculiar. But Professor, if it's a not known entity, a new one, what did you do with those patients? You still had to do with them, with the infections and things like that. What were the first treatment options that you prescribed? How did you deal with this?
I had the idea these individuals are burdened with allergies. I tried antihistamines, no result. And then I had the idea maybe some similarities with asthma. Let's try topical acting corticosteroids. I took formulations designed for asthma, for inhalation, and I instructed my patients to swallow this powder, and it worked.
With the inhalator?
Yes, not to inhale, but to swallow the liquid of budesonide or of fluticasone, and it worked. It worked for symptoms, and it worked regarding the inflammation. The topical active corticosteroids, this was the clue that opened the way to the treatment of this chronic disease.
So it's actually started with the steroids instead of PPI, right?
Yes.
It's interesting.
Why didn't I use PPI? Because the patients didn't claim reflux symptoms. It was not reflux, burning, things like that. They had a solid food dysphagia and no endoscopic signs of reflux. And therefore, I started with steroids.
Oh, seems logical. Professor, full disclosure, when I diagnose a eosinophilic esophagitis, I'm always very apprehensive. Not because it's something very dramatic, but because I know that at some point in the treatment or surveillance, there will be a question that I don't know the answer. And most probably, there's no known answer currently. So it's a very, very uncomfortable position to be. So one other question is, what is the actual difference between eosinophilic esophagitis and esophageal eosinophilia that responds to PPI?
Esophageal eosinophilia, briefly EE or EE, is a histological diagnosis. If the esophagus is inflamed, infiltrated with eosinophils, then you have an esophageal eosinophilia. But this is absolutely non-specific, because an eosinophil infiltration can occur under many, many different conditions. If you have a sunburn, that in the late phase, when pain disappears, the edema disappears, you take a biopsy from your skin, then you have eosinophils. The eosinophils is a late phase inflammatory cell with a lot of repair capacities and absolutely nonspecific. EE, as esophageal eosinophilia, is a histological diagnosis. And EoE, eosinophilic esophagitis is a clinical pathological diagnosis. That means you need symptoms, solid food dysphagia. Drinking is no problem, but as more solid the food is, as more problems you have. And on the other hand, the histology. And honestly, the chronicity is a third pillar of the diagnosis. The symptoms, solid food dysphagia, the histology with the eosinophilic infiltration and the chronicity. These are the elements. Then you can diagnose EoE. It's a clinical pathological diagnosis.
Okay, so basically EoE is always esophageal eosinophilia, but not every esophageal eosinophilia is EoE.
Absolutely.
Okay, good to know.
EoE is esophageal eosinophilia and symptoms. Problem, solid food dysphagia. You have problems if you swallow solid food. This both, it's clinical pathological defined.
But what do you think about the diagnostic, histopathological diagnostic criteria in your EoE? We have a cutoff of like 15 eosinophils per magnifying field. Is it a good standard? And does it reflect, and if the patient has 14, does it mean that the patient does not have eosinophilic esophagitis?
No, it's an arbitrary threshold. In theory, the esophagus is the only segment of the GI tract which is free of eosinophils. But nature is never black or white. You have to accept some eosinophils in the esophagus, and even the reflux, the GERD, can induce an esophageal eosinophilia. Also, this threshold is arbitrary, and only in combination with the symptoms you can establish the diagnosis EoE. A relevant inflammation, eosinophilic inflammation together with symptoms of solid food dysphagia.
Okay. Now that we've established this, what do we need for the diagnosis? But it is known that there's a huge discordance between patient-reported symptoms and histological findings. So we need both, but then they are not concordant. And if we can't have both in the treatment, which is more important?
Both are important. But the symptoms are a pitfall, a diagnostic pitfall. Very often you hear, I have no swallowing problems, but I never would eat a steak. I never would eat a pizza. I only eat soups and I drink a lot of tea and beer. Patients adapt rapidly and avoid critical food. And therefore, you have to ask, would you eat a dry sandwich without any mineral water? Even in stress, you are sitting in the car, you have a meeting, you are on delay, and now you have nothing else to eat than your sandwich. Would you eat under this situation a sandwich without any mineral water? And patient said, yes, then he has really no solid food dysphagia. This is the provocative question.
So this is your diagnostic criteria, measurement. Okay.
Yes, for symptoms, to make the hidden symptom of dysphagia apparent, to bring it on the surface.
Okay, but once we've diagnosed, there are treatment options, as lacking as they are, and you started with the topical steroids. But what are the current options that we can safely prescribe or offer our patients?
EoE is a food allergy. If you can live only without any food, then your EoE is quiet. But as soon as you eat food, in particular proteins, then starts an allergy. It's a food allergy. It's a late phase food allergy. Unfortunately, not IgE mediated. And therefore, you have two options. Either you can identify the culprit food, then you have the option of a diet, of an exclusion diet, or you suppress this chronic destructive inflammation with medications. First line, topical corticosteroids, if it not works with biologics. The problem to figure out the culprit food is rather cumbersome because we have no tests. It's not an IgE-mediated allergy. The skin tests, the food-specific serum IgE values are not helpful. We have no tests to figure out the culprit food except a diet. You say, for instance, avoid for 3 months every milk product, every dairy product. And then you have to ask for the symptoms. What happens with the symptoms? You have to scope the patient to take biopsies, and then you can see it works or it doesn't work. With milk, with dairy products, you have a chance up to 40% that it works. Symptoms disappear and inflammation disappears. But if it does not work, you can propose, let's try with gluten. Maybe you have the chances is smaller than for dairy products, but you have about a 20% chance. But you see, this is cumbersome, time-consuming with repeated endoscopies.
Yeah, and also I was wondering, because in all the schemes about eosinophilic esophagitis, there's this one arrow allergen graph that contributes to the inflammation because of cross-reaction. So even if we eliminate the culprit food, how do we avoid the other allergens that might cause a reaction?
We have two case reports that EOE was induced by arrow allergens. But this is the exception. And we know from treatment studies with amino acid formulation, a diet without any proteins, you have in children and in adults more than 90% response. If you don't eat any food proteins, any proteins, then you have a huge chance that your EOE gets quiet. But these amino acid formulations have two handicaps. They are expensive and they have an ugly taste. It's not a long-term solution. Yeah.
Nah, because if we will talk about the endpoints, the quality of life on that thing, I'm not sure it's worth it. I'd rather have a stricture.
We have two endpoints for the treatment. One, the most important from the patient's perspective and the physician's perspective, is a control of symptoms. If we start on a level of the visual analog scale on the level 10, I would say if the symptoms are below 3, then we are happy. And patients normally are happy as well. And the second criteria is the inflammation, the histology. If we have values less than 15, maybe less than 20 in reality, in practice, then we have a good feeling that even over a long term, that we don't risk a bad evolution of a thing, that the quality of life is pretty good for the patient and that we have no relevant long-term risks.
Okay, so we're good on what we are trying to achieve.
But you see, the two treatment options, the diet is theoretically very attractive because we don't need any medications. but has two handicaps. First, to figure out which food category is the culprit food. And the second one, almost always staple food like milk products or gluten. And you need a long-term treatment. It's not only 1 month or 1 week. And staple food elimination over long-term is a challenge for the patients. And the other option, you suppress the ugly inflammation with medications. And in our cohort with almost 1,000 EUA patients, only 14% are under diet. The vast majority uses medications to control their symptoms and to control their inflammation.
And how do you present these options? As equal to the patient and it's their decision, or do you favor some, one of which?
No, we favor the medications. Why? The patient is symptomatic and he is eager that something happen. And then we start with medication because we have a huge chance, almost 80%, that within few days or maybe 1 or 2 weeks, symptoms disappear and the inflammation disappears. And this is a dramatic experience for the patient. He is immediately convinced now this works. If you start with diet, first you have to figure out which food category is the culprit food. This takes time. And if you have the culprit food and you avoid it, the onset is much slower. Symptoms disappear over weeks and weeks, and not as dramatic, as rapid as with the medication. And therefore, we start with topical acting corticosteroids, but we explain to patients, it's a food allergy. And if you're eager to know which food, then we can start with. If the patient is eager, we stop the medication and we discuss, let's start with dairy product or let's start with gluten. We propose dairy because the chance is bigger than with gluten. And then, but the start normally we are doing with medications.
Okay, so Professor, we do have a consensus that we're starting our patients on steroids. And let's see what happens next in the second part.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you've found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues.
Enjoyed this episode? You can also find it on Gutflix, the streaming platform for digestive health professionals. Discover expert courses, UEG Week recordings, and podcasts, all personalized to your clinical interests. Visit gutflix.eu and start your GI learning experience.